listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A key victory in Venezuela for President Nicolas Maduro and his ruling Socialist Party. For more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua, Nicaragua, Monday. Tony, this looks like an affirmation pretty strong terms of the Maduro government by the voters. Almost, the last report I saw, almost 6 million votes, which everyone was saying was an unattainable target, and a very lopsided victory, and also a victory against the boycott, because lots of people turned. The turnout was pretty much comparable to a U.S. presidential election.
Yeah, or to an election in neighboring Colombia, for example.
Right.
The final figure is over 9 million voters, which works out at something like 46% of the electorate, and the Nicolas Maduro's broad Polo Patriotico front, the Patriotic Pole front.
Right.
They won. They got over. They did get over 6 million. I think it was almost 6.2 million.
Right.
And if you compare that with the elections, the legislative elections back in 2015, back then, the opposition mobilized their supporters. And the Chavista vote didn't turn out. And back then, there was 74% participation. And the opposition won, and I think they got something like 7 million votes, 8 million votes, something like that, altogether.
Right.
So... It's almost impossible to compare this election with any other election because the circumstances are so specific. And after 2 years of extreme polarization, last year was an extremely violent time in Venezuela. The violence only came to a stop in July with the Constituent Assembly, in which the government supporters mobilized very effectively, and I think a total of 8 million people voted in that election. So yeah. In this election, you've had a total of 9 million people voting.
Right.
The actual figure for the government is of over 6 million is a real triumph, and no matter how the opposition local media in Venezuela or how the opposition corporate media in North America and Europe play it, this is very much a personal triumph for Nicolas Maduro and for his policies, and a really powerful political triumph for the United Socialist Party of Venezuela and their political allies. Now, because, and even if the opposition had mobilized, and say that there'd been between 11 and 13,000 voters turning out, and of those extra votes, a lot of people didn't vote because they just assumed there was no point because Maduro was going to win anyway.
Right.
So a lot of the Chavista voters just didn't bother. So if you added, say, 2 or 3 million voters onto the number that did vote, Nicolas Maduro would still have won by a good margin. So it's difficult for anybody to kind of objectively claim that this isn't a genuine electoral victory. I know, of course it is. And when you put that in regional terms, and if you compare the election campaign and the election process in Venezuela with what's going on in Mexico, just for an example, and Mexico's got a very complicated set of elections happening sometime in July, covering various different levels of the Mexican state's institutions, including most importantly the presidency. But since that electoral process began last year, something like October last year, and since that electoral process began, over 100 candidates have been killed.
Yeah.
Of course, that barely gets reported in the Western corporate media. But and I think it's a very valid comparison to show the comparative integrity and the incomparable integrity in many ways of Venezuela's electoral process and its electoral system in general.
Right.
So, and if you look at what's happening in Colombia, and in Colombia's election campaign, there's been very serious threats against candidates like Gustavo Petro, and I think a couple of people involved in the election campaign have also suffered actual political violence, if not been killed. But and since the start of the year, hardly a day has gone by without the murder of some community activist or some former FARC guerrilla or every violence is endemic in Colombia, in the country's political life. And so when you compare this recent electoral process in Venezuela with what's been going on in Mexico and Colombia, and Colombia goes to for its elections next Sunday on the 27th, a week after this yesterday's election in Venezuela. So, But the comparison between Venezuela and its neighbors, or Colombia, Mexico, and even Brazil, and that's a whole other story, isn't it? But and the comparison makes Venezuela look exemplary in terms of its electoral institutions and in terms of its electoral process.
Yeah, the Lima Group, they call themselves. Yeah, Peru, Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, Panama, Paraguay, Colombia, Honduras. You know, they issue a statement saying they don't recognize the legitimacy of the election. Well, who wrote it? Did Temer write it for Brazil? Or did the newly not elected president of Honduras write it that stole the election a few months ago? Or, you know, which one of these characters, Paraguay, did that coup government write it? I mean, which one of these characters wrote it? Mexico? Maybe we should let Mexico monitor the elections for the Western Hemisphere for a year, a rotating chair or something with Honduras and Brazil.
Yeah, I mean, clearly in the regional context, and for those countries to question Venezuela's electoral process is ridiculous. But leaving the actual integrity of the electoral process and the unquestionable validity of the result to one side, you then have the question of what does that mean in regional terms, in terms of U.S. policy in the region, given that it's the United States government that is the most important player in terms of rolling back the gains of progressive governments between 2006 and 2013. Particular,
right.
And what that this election is a very serious setback for the United States, the United States government.
There's another thing to look at too here. You know, the numbers that I'm looking at now that you know from CILA, that are published in Telesur. So it says about 6,190,612 for Maduro. Is that about what you show? Okay. So for him to win, you know, forget the right wing did what they did. They called a boycott. Was it honored? Was it not? I don't know. Falcon only got less than 2 million votes. Okay.
And around 21%.
Okay. So, but in terms of absolute terms, back in 2012, when Chavez ran last time, turnout was 80%, 80.52%, okay? And there were 14 and a half million votes. Now, if you were to look at turnout of, say, 70%, which is the U.S., the highest it's had in the last 50 years was in 2008 at 61%. Okay, so that's their baseline. In 1960, otherwise, was in 62%. If that's their baseline, well, Maduro wins at 70% with the vote that he already has. If every other vote went for the other side.
Yeah. I know. The questioning the result is ridiculous.
Yep.
And the opposition have only themselves to blame that they boycotted the election. So now, they effectively disenfranchised their own supporters, which is likely to be another factor that will continue to leave the opposition politicians and their base, their electoral base, completely demoralised. And I know if you look back at what happened in 2005, I think it was in 2005 they had legislative elections in Venezuela, and there again the opposition boycotted that, and it was a really foolish mistake. And this is also another foolish mistake, because essentially what a majority of people in Venezuela have decided are that they'd rather face all the difficulties imposed by the United States sanctions and the sanctions of other Latin American countries than accept a right-wing government of the stripe of Venezuela's opposition politicians. And that's what a damning indictment. you know, after 2 years of economic sanctions and boycott and all the extreme economic suffering that people have had to endure as a result of the sabotage of the economy, the inflation, abuse of the exchange rate, smuggling, you know, and as combined with European countries and other US allies boycotting the supply of food and medicines to ordinary people in Venezuela. Despite all that, people in Venezuela decided on by a majority vote to support President Maduro because they trust him. They trust him to solve their problems.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, can we start looking at the regional context?
I want to make sure people get this point here. If you look also at the 2012 election, which had Chavez, that was his last election, and that was the big effort behind Capriles. That was the opposition's biggest moment in these presidential elections since 1998. He's tied Maduro after everything that's happened in the last 6 years is still tied with Capriles on that date.
And that's an important point to make as well. This was the 25th electoral process in Venezuela since 1998. The opposition have won two. And they won those two electoral processes using exactly the same electoral institutions and the same electoral mechanisms that they lost with the other 23. So, you know, there's no question that these elections are a tremendous milestone, a historic milestone for Venezuela, especially given the current context. But looking at the wider context in Latin America, and it looks as though the Lima Group countries, a total of 12 countries, all run by right-wing governments that more or less side one way or another with the United States government on a broad range, but not all, foreign policy issues. They've decided to try and isolate Venezuela. They've called their ambassadors back for consultations. And so it's likely that the United States and its allies are likely to intensify all the regime change measures that they have in that regime change repertoire.
Right.
And it remains to be seen how, you know, what will China and Russia do? They've already stated that they recognize the validity of the elections in Venezuela, Maduro's election victory, and they expect other countries to do the same. They've already said that. The United States has said that it's not going to recognize the result, but no surprise there. And their allies in the region, the Lima Group mainly, and are not recognizing the result. But that still leaves the Organization of American States, for example, unable to take any measures against Venezuela because they do not have a majority in the Organization of American States to do so.
Right.
That's why they formed the Lima Group.
Right.
And the formation of the Lima Group is actually an admission of weakness on the part of the right wing in the region because they don't have a majority even in the U.S. kind of Ministry of the Colonies, which is the function of the Organization of American States. This election result in Venezuela is a tremendous blow to this ridiculous idea of, you know, there's this unstoppable conservative restoration and the right wing are going to take over Latin America. And I think we have to look at it, stepping back even from the region, looking at it in a global sense.
Yeah.
Since 2005, Most independent observers have been absolutely clear that from 2005 to that period in which the United States was unable to win the Iraq War, and from that period on, it's been absolutely clear that around now, 2019, 2020, 2021, that there was a window of opportunity for the United States and its allies to reach an accommodation with emerging global rivals like China, like Russia, like the BRICS countries, and for a time, and that might again get renewed life over the next couple of years. We'll see. So much depends what happens in Brazil, but it was very clear that that window of opportunity was closing, and that around now, 2019-2020, and the United States would run out of options, and they've lost, to put it in that crass way, they've lost Eurasia. Okay.
Yeah.
So what are their options? Their main option is to try and impose their will on the fabulous resource riches of Latin America.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing, and that's what the so-called conservative restoration is all about. It's got nothing to do with democratic politics.
More conservatism, more restorations. It has to do with resources.
It has to do with resources. And that is why this election in Venezuela is absolutely historic, because despite everything that the United States has done over the last 2-3 years to try and impose its will in the region, there are still centers like Venezuela and Bolivia, extraordinarily wealthy in resource terms, that resist it. And so now what are they going to do? Their only real option is some kind of military action.
Right.
Because they've just lost. And their economic sanctions haven't worked. And it doesn't matter. I can't see what else they can do. They can intensify them, but Venezuela is resourceful enough to be able to deal with that and cope with that. And thanks to its global relationship with Russia and China.
Yeah.
And, you know, Russia and China have huge investments in Venezuela. They aren't going to let the US walk away with that. So I think it's difficult to overstate the significance of this election result in terms of a defeat for the United States, because it is a defeat. It doesn't matter how they spin it. So then, and that also explains events that are happening here in Nicaragua, for example.
Right.
Which are Nicaragua is an unconditional ally of Venezuela and Cuba.
Right.
And so, why would the United States care about a tiny country of a little over 6 million people? Because they need every vote they can get in the Organization of American States in order to institutionalize, in the terms of international institutions and international relations, to legitimize their aggression, their completely legitimate aggression against Venezuela. And that's why they're putting so much pressure on Nicaragua, and in broader terms, they need all the help they can get in terms of their international foreign policy, which goes against decades of UN resolutions. And look at what's happening in Israel, and the United States government has moved their embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And who have they asked to support them doing that? Tiny countries like Paraguay, Honduras, and Guatemala. Why would they worry about the support of these small countries? Because they are desperate to try and legitimize they're completely illegal and unlawful foreign policy decisions.
Well, this is like the annual ritual that took place at the UN for many years, where the General Assembly would vote on a condemnation resolution of the U.S. Sanctions against Cuba. And you would have, you know, the entire global community, say 189 of the 193 members of the UN, voting to condemn the United States, and on the other side, the U.S., Israel, and, say, Palau, or the Marshall Islands, which are essentially U.S. military bases in the Pacific. It's the same thing we see now with Israel. That's exactly right.
And those islands, I mean, it's way off our beat, but I mean, those Pacific islands are kind of almost literally colonial fiefdoms.
Yeah, if that.
Of U.S. allies like New Zealand and Australia.
That's right.
And New Zealand and Australia have zero moral credentials in terms of their abject implementation of colonial controls over those territories on behalf of United States interests. And there was an interesting article in Global Times on that subject, but shame on New Zealand in particular for getting that is so many people regard as some kind of model of democracy.
I know, on somebody else's land. I don't want to run too far afield, and we're getting close to running out of time. You have Nicaragua's election in 2016 was a definite pushback in the trend that was being announced of this so-called rollback of the pink tide or the conservative restoration when President Ortega essentially whooped some behind. He won with 72% of the vote in November of 2016, and the party secured more than two-thirds, or just exactly two-thirds, of the national legislature. You also have coming up. You know, you had the losses in Argentina and Venezuela a couple of years back in the National Assembly election, which has been corrected since in Venezuela, and the election of Macri in Argentina. Well, Macri's, election, his day of reckoning is next year, and then the push out of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, that day of reckoning is this year. In each of October 2018 and 2019, you have respectively Brazil's presidential election and then Argentina's. And, you know, those are the two heavy hitters in the region. And also
in Mexico.
That's right. That's huge. And so what happened, well, particularly, though, with respect to Argentina and Brazil, what happened in Venezuela yesterday is huge in that context. Maybe you could draw some lines to Mexico from Venezuela also.
Yeah, I'm the Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the progressive candidate there, and he's a kind of social democrat style nationalist politician. Who's been cheated of one election after another. He's now leading the electoral preferences in the opinion polls with something like 42% support. And his nearest rival is kind of on something like 29 or 30, something like that. In Mexico, and if Andrés Manuel López Obrador wins, and that too, in all the signs are that he'll win unless they assassinate him. And that, too, will be a tremendous setback for the United States in the region because under Peña Nieto, and Mexico has been a kind of supine right-wing ally, in certainly on regional terms. And although it's been followed a much more independent line in terms of its relations, global trade relations with China, for example. So, and if AMLO, as he's called in Mexico, wins there, depending, as you say, on what happens in Brazil this year, and it's still not clear whether Lula will actually be able to be a presidential candidate or not, that still has to be decided, although it looks almost impossible at the moment. Who knows? Stranger things have happened. So, this year, 2000, I remember saying that in a previous conversation that I thought 2018 would be a much more difficult, conflictive year, even than 2017. And I think that's proven to be the case, because the United States is not going to have things all its own way, and it's not likely to react well to that fact.
Yeah. And I mean, we're looking at what's happened in this region sort of follow what happened in Africa under the Obama administration with it, and what happened in the Middle East and Southwest Asia in the previous administrations. You had a whole different landscape before the second war in Iraq in the Middle East, and also a whole different landscape in Africa before the takedown of Libya and Cote d'Ivoire, a reestablishment of French imperialism across Northwest Africa and West Africa, the consolidation of the militaries of 35 African countries into the U.S. African Command, essentially a recolonization of the African continent, a destruction, if you look at a map, of the String of Pearls and the Silk Road running through the region, the Middle East, essentially craters where the U.S. just blew up some of those stepping stones. And now they turn their attention to Latin America. And although they've been taking it back piece by piece, this was a huge victory in Venezuela that I think is going to set the tone going forward. And since we're pretty much out of time, so I think to take this up again next week and maybe work, what else can happen this year.
Sure. Look forward to it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tony. Thank you for your time, as always.
Okay.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The American pullout out of the Iran nuclear deal is causing a headache to the European guarantors of the treaty. In case of Germany, threatening firms that made large investments in Iran. How will Berlin and the EU deal with this? Well, I ask Günther Verheugen, former vice president of the European Commission.
Washington's scuttling of the Iran nuclear deal has taken Europe by surprise. German businesses in the Middle Eastern country now under threat of renewed American sanctions. Berlin may be turning to Russia to keep the nuclear agreement on board. Can the Iran debacle restore broken ties between Russia and Germany? Will the countries be able to mount a concerted effort to maintain the nuclear deal? And will it be enough to save it?
Günther Verheugen, former vice president of the European Commission, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us today.
Hello, Sophie. Good to see you.
So after Trump took America out of the Iran deal, which means that European companies in Iran may be subject to American sanctions, the EU fired back, activating a law that would block European companies from complying with U.S. decisions on Iran. In your opinion, who is going to out-sanction who here, the United States or Europe?
I'm afraid that the Americans have the bigger stick here. If you were in a European company or a German car maker, for instance, and you would look at the figures, what kind of business are you doing in Iran? What kind of business are you doing in the United States? You have not much choice. And you will decide not to invest in Iran. You will continue to invest and to make business in U.S. And if the European Union would really promise to compensate for all the losses, I can promise you that goes far, far beyond the financial capacities of the European Union. So I'm really afraid that the American policy of unilateral action, the American policy of taking hostage other nations and companies, can be successful at the end.
So the European statute that has been activated prohibits EU companies from cancelling their business with Iran due to American sanctions. So let's say if I'm a European company in Iran, I have to suffer the consequences brought onto me by the Americans. And if I quit Iran, then EU will go after me. Doesn't this put EU companies between the devil and the deep blue sea? How is that making their life easier?
No, I don't think that the problem is the role of the companies which are already active in Iran. The problem is that the promise that went with the Iran deal was that we would do more and help Iran to develop the economy and to increase the living standard of the people. So that would mean much, much more investment than we have done in the past. And what I have said is, and I would like to repeat that, you cannot expect new major investment in Iran coming from major European companies, in particular those who are world market leaders, who are leading in technology and innovation. I'm really afraid that the American action was well calculated, and that we have no real defense against it.
So, regardless of Europe's countermeasures, do you think the deal will survive without the Americans?
I think it can. It depends very much on the cooperation between the guarantor countries, in particular Russia, China, and the European countries. As far as I can see, they are committed to do everything they can to keep the deal alive. But for the people in Iran, of course, the question will be, does it pay at the end? That I cannot foresee. But what we can say is, this deal is clearly in jeopardy. And with the deal in jeopardy is the whole system of nuclear non-proliferation, not only in the area of the Middle East, but everywhere. And it might change the whole security pattern of the world in which we live. It's a really serious, very, very serious situation. And in this situation, it would be extremely important to organize cooperation between the other partners of the deal, which I have already mentioned, in order to create a counterweight.
So in the wake of the United States' decision on Iran, Donald Tusk says that with friends like US, you don't need enemies. And Trump said the same can be said about EU. Are US and EU enemies from now on?
Absolutely not. I must say, I know Donald Tusk very well, and I like him very much. And normally he is not using strong words, so I was really surprised. So my understanding was that he was really, really angry about the communication with the Americans. No, I wouldn't use the term enemy, but it is obvious that partnership between the United States and the European Union is entering a new age. It's not like it was in the past when more or less the Americans and the Europeans shared the same values and objectives. The Europeans accepted that Americans have the leadership and the Americans were generous enough to provide security. I think that's finished. That's finished. And we need to redefine the relationship. And the only thing I would like to say right now is, we in Europe, we should not make the mistake to believe that the presidency of Donald Trump is just a short-living mistake. I'm afraid that Trump is representing America much more than Obama represented America, and we should be aware that this policy will probably continue, the America First policy.
So the French finance minister is calling on European leaders to defend Europe's economic sovereignty from the United States. Now, at the same time, he and his German colleagues are courting their U.S. counterparts, Team Nuchin, trying to get exemptions for their companies from the looming sanctions. So what kind of sovereignty is this if Europe is repeatedly finding itself in begging positions towards the United States?
Yeah, it's the old problem. The discussion is very old. How to deal with the Americans and different views are more common than unity. I have to confess, and I'm not surprised because the French interests and the German interests are definitely not the same. And so far, the European institutions did not manage to create a common position and. My view is it will be difficult, very, very difficult. Do we really want to have to create a trade war with the United States? The United States is the strongest economic partner for the European Union, and vice versa. Yeah, we are very much depending on each other. There will be no winner in a trade war. And my view is it should be avoided as much as we can. Because we cannot accept that the Americans dictate the terms of the business. It has to be partnership. But as long as we do not know whether the partnership is really finished, we should try to keep it alive.
So Germany was previously slammed by the United States for failing to pay its share of 2% of its GDP to the NATO budget. Trump now says member countries must pay 4% of their GDP to NATO. Is Germany planning to meet this target if almost nobody in Europe is even meeting the 2% target? How is Washington going to make everyone pay for it?
I can tell you that a strong majority of Germans, and in my view, a strong majority of Europeans everywhere, is strictly against a new arms race and do not see the need for higher defense spending in the European Union than we already have. We can create synergies in the European Union by cooperating better in defense matters. We have started to do that, but I would strictly oppose the idea that we have to spend 2% of our GDP for common defense. And it's, in my view, an even higher percentage is absolutely not debatable.
So Trump also says that those underpaying to the NATO budget will be dealt with, whatever that means. That's almost at the same time as he's threatening sanctions on Europe over Iran. I mean, why does Europe and Germany in particular allow United States to blackmail them here and there? Because that's what it looks like from the outside.
Yes, I agree. And in the past, the European attitude the American policy was always a mixture of megalomania and strict obedience. So we never found the right middle here. So we need to discuss now what we want to have. And need to tell our American friends that until now, the EU-US axis was a guarantor for peace and stability, not only in Europe but in other regions as well. If that axis disappears, we will have more tensions. We will have more conflict. The world will come closer to the final conflict. And nobody, even Mr. Trump, I believe, nobody can really want that. So we must do everything we can to prevent the situation from happening where the Americans and the Europeans are in different camps. But I know it's going to be difficult. I know that.
All right, so we're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to Günther Verheugen, former vice president of the European Commission, talking about the German-Russian relations. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
We're back with Günther Verheugen, former vice president of the European Commission, discussing the uneasy German-Russian partnership. All right, so the new German foreign minister, Mr. Maas, has started his tenure by taking a tough stance on Russia. But just a little while later, we see Germany and Russia standing together in support of the Iran deal against American attempts to dismantle it. Can one of the effects of the Iran deal affair be to actually bring Germany and Russia closer together?
Yes, I think it does. We have a very strong common interest here, and perhaps it shows us that there are many, many other areas where we have common interests. As far as the new foreign minister in Germany is concerned, he is learning on the job, and perhaps we should give him a little bit of time. I was slightly surprised when he made that announcement, because this is not the policy that was formulated in the coalition agreement, and it's clearly not the policy of the Social Democratic Party, to which he belongs. My feeling is that a strong, strong majority, not only of Social Democrats in Germany, but of the whole German population, wants good and friendly relations with Russia and strongly dislikes the confrontational policy that we have seen during the last time.
In his first interview as German Foreign Minister, Mr. Maas was using words like belligerent, hostile when speaking about Russia, something no acting German foreign minister was heard saying before. Should Maas be seen as Berlin's mouthpiece here? I mean, at the same time, Chancellor Merkel is meeting with Putin and saying that relations with Russia are a strategic priority, countries need to talk. So does the German government have a united line on Russia at the moment or not?
Good question. I'm not a member of this government, so I do not know, but I noticed the discrepancy which you have mentioned, and I would not have used the terms which Mr. Maas used, and perhaps he will not repeat it. My understanding is that Chancellor Merkel is very much interested in maintaining constructive relations and building confidence, and she is the one who defines the guidelines of Germany's foreign policy. So give the present coalition in Berlin a little bit time to adjust. My understanding is the policy line will be to try to cooperate with Russia as much as possible.
Like you have mentioned, the attitude that Mr. Maas has taken towards Russia has brought sharp criticism from his own party members and other German politicians. It seems that while the German course on Russia is in line with the EU, there is an internal political divide in the German establishment when it comes to relations with Moscow. How deep is this divide and how does it affect policy?
Yes, that is a matter that concerns me very, very much. What I can see since a couple of years, but getting stronger and stronger, is a divide between, how shall I say that, the normal population and the so-called intellectual elites, people in the media, people in think tanks, people also in political positions. They have a much, much tougher position than the average German citizen. And we have similar situation in other areas as well, that the elites in our country are losing contact with the interests and the views of the people. So and this is serious in a democracy. If normal people and the elites have completely different views. And if you ask me who should change, my answer is clear. I think that those people writing articles increasing the tensions and the confrontation should rethink what they are doing.
So I agree with what you're saying because I have statistics here that said it's from Der Spiegel. It says that 68% of Germans don't want to toughen the stance on Russia, and overwhelming 94% of Germans think that good relations with Russia are important. Will exactly. The opinion of voters pressure the German leaders to find a softer approach to the German-Russia relations in the end?
Now it depends. It depends on what happens in reality. Foreign policy is not a matter of words. Foreign policy is a matter of deeds. So we have to see whether we can find common ground in those areas where we have common interests, like Middle East, like Iran, perhaps even Ukraine. In my view, an area where we have common interests, and of course, economy and technology. A good partnership and a good relationship needs substance. Yeah, we need to do something, and here we should not forget that the bilateral relations between Germany and Russia, despite all the disturbing words and voices, are still very good. We have very strong cultural relations. We have very strong economic relations. We have extremely strong cooperation between people and organizations from the civil society. We shouldn't underestimate that. I believe that finally, German policy will understand that we in Germany have a particular responsibility to make sure that Russia is treated as an equal partner in Europe.
So even if there is a political decision in Berlin to, for example, I don't know, ease the sanctions on Russia, there are approved by all EU member states. So are Germany's hands tied on the issue, regardless of whether the government wants to lift sanctions or not?
Yeah. The sanctions are a European decision, and a single country like Germany cannot change it. We need a common decision here. But I believe if conditions are there which would allow the German government or another government to say we do not need the sanctions any longer, they would like to do that rather sooner than later. Nobody really likes the sanctions. The Germans not, the French not, Italians not, and the other. Nobody really likes it. I would hope contacts which will follow create another atmosphere, a better climate, and then in the next step, we can have a European decision to lift the sanctions step by step or in one step. It depends on the situation.
So meanwhile, as Germany goes along with EU sanctions, it still manages to do lots of business with Russia. For instance, building the Nord Stream 2 giant pipeline, bringing natural gas into Germany directly from Russia. So how does Berlin balance this tough and principled diplomacy approach with pragmatic pipeline projects?
Yeah, Nord Stream 2 in Berlin's view, as far as I understand it, I was not involved in decision making here. As far as I understand it, the position of the German government is that Nord Stream 2 is in the interest not only of Germany, but also in the interest of our neighboring countries in the East, in particular Poland and the Baltic countries. I think that Mrs. Merkel made it clear that Nord Stream 2 does not mean necessarily that Ukraine is losing its importance as a transit country for gas. So, I think the best solution would be to find a way that satisfies the needs of Ukraine and Poland by guaranteeing that a certain amount of energy will be transported via these countries, and then Nord Stream 2, which we need to meet the demand in gas in Europe, because the demand is not shrinking. The demand is increasing, as everybody knows.
So Merkel made it clear recently that Nord Stream 2 project shouldn't go forward until all the issues with Ukraine's transit role are settled. She said that there are political considerations involved. How does this go along with German government officials' numerous statements that Nord Stream 2 is purely commercial project?
Yeah, it does not go along with that. It does not, and I do not know whether the German government has a legal instrument to stop that. I don't think so. So this was a political statement. In my view, it would be wise to do as I have already said, find a balanced solution which also takes into account the interests of Ukraine and Poland. But Nord Stream 2 is, as you have said, for economic reasons, absolutely important for Germany and the rest of Europe.
So why is Nord Stream 2 deemed so dangerous in Brussels? I mean, the Germans are pragmatic people. They wouldn't sign up for something if it were really strategically dangerous. Isn't more infrastructure always a good thing?
Yeah, I would agree. And the opposition is not new. There was already tough opposition against Nord Stream 1, as you remember. The Poles were complaining a lot, and some other countries as well. And we have the same situation. The Poles feel that they are bypassed here, literally bypassed. The decision was made without consulting them, and in my view, that was a mistake. One should have tried to have the Poles on board, but that is spilled milk now. Again, the best solution would be taking into account the rising demand for gas from Russia, a division of labor, so to say, between Nord Stream 2 and the traditional transport lines which we already have.
All right. Thank you very much for this interesting talk. We were talking to Günther Verheugen, former vice president of the European Commission, discussing European efforts to rescue the Iran deal and Germany's relations with Russia. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I will see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.